Hey, good evening, everyone. We're broadcasting live. May 8th. So I think today we'll do another Dhammapada. Hello. Test. Okay. So that means no video. Need to get to the Dhammapada. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verses 131 and 132, which read as follows. Sukha kamani bhutani yo dandena vihinsati atano sukame sano pechaso nalabhate sukham. Sukha kamani bhutani yo dandena na hingsati atano sukhame sano pechaso labhate sukham. It's a twin pair of verses. They're saying the same thing but in opposition. So 131 means sukha kamani bhutani, those beings that desire happiness, yo dandena vihingsati, who harms them with a stick or with a weapon, atano sukame sano, by one who is seeking for happiness, meaning the person doing the harming. So a person harming someone who wishes for happiness, harming beings that wish for happiness, they themselves seeking happiness. Pechaso nalabhate sukham. In the future they do not attain happiness. And 132 is the opposite. If someone does not harm others with a stick, the other beings that seek happiness, that wish for happiness, want happiness, oneself seeking happiness, one does find happiness in the future. So this is the Dhamma for today. The story behind these verses, it's regarding a group of boys who the Buddha saw on his way to Savatthi. So the Buddha lived in Jetavana for many years of his life. You can still go and see the ruins of the ancient monastery in India. And you can walk from, it's actually quite a ways, but you can walk from Jetavana to Savatthi. And in Savatthi there are two kind of pyramid type things, or probably maybe they were round at one point, but they're kind of square, kind of pyramid type things that are said to be the monuments to Angulimala and Anathapindika. And if you go up on top of the stupa, you can see the walls of Savatthi. You can see the ruined city. And so when the Buddha was on his way into Savatthi, he saw a bunch of boys beating a snake with a stick. It's an interesting sort of a humanizing story where the Buddha meets with a bunch of children and how he teaches children. Of course, this is the commentary again. We don't have any evidence that this actually happened, but it's an interesting look into how the Buddha behaved or how people remember him, to the things people remember him to have done. So he asked them, "What are you doing?" "Kumaraka, young men, kingarota, what are you doing?" "Ahingvante dandakena baharama." "It's a snake, venerable sir, we are beating it with a stick." And the Buddha said, "Kingarna, for what reason?" And they said, "Dangsana bhayena vante." "We're afraid of its bite, venerable sir." And the Buddha shook his head and smiled. And when he shook his head, he said, "Tumhe," you think to yourself, "Tumhe," that you think to yourself, "Atano sukang karisama," we will make happiness for ourselves. We will bring ourselves happiness. And for that reason, imang paharanta, you beat this stick. You beat the snake with a stick. But he said, "You will not be nibata nibata tane in whatever places you are born. Sukalabino nabhavisati. You will not be ones who attain happiness. Atano sukam patin tena hi parang parhi paharitum nabhati." One is not able to, the beating with a stick does not go for, I don't quite get that, but basically beating others doesn't lead to happiness. And so he taught this verse. So simple, I mean it ties in a lot with the past two stories and the past two verses about one should not hurt others, oneself not wishing harm. But the curious thing here is the logic of the boys, because it seems like sound logic, right? We're afraid he'll bite us, we're afraid of the bite of the snake. But of course, if you think for a moment about it, the snake wasn't actually, most likely wasn't actually a danger to the boys, right? They just found this snake and they thought, oh, well, he might bite us, so we better kill it. But the snake wasn't looking to bite a human, the snake was probably looking for a smaller animal to kill. Not to say snakes aren't vicious, evil animals, but I mean, we do recognize that as a, at least a small evil. Oh, I mean, fair evil, snakes killing other animals and biting them. But it wasn't doing harm to the boys. And so it's a good example of our tendency to focus more on a cure, focus more on the cure to a problem than the cause of a problem. So there's a good example of that, but it's an important delusion or error that we make. That it was a problem that we have that leads to errors in judgment. So take these boys, for example. They think the problem is this, they think the cause of their problem is the snake, right? The snake is causing problems. And so immediately, they look for a solution. They don't consider and they don't look closely at the cause, at what the real problem is. And so they focus on the solution and immediately beat the snake. You know, if I get rid of the snake, then my problem will be over. But they haven't understood the problem. And in fact, the real problem is not the snake, it's the fear. That's what they say, we're afraid he will bite us. And so without investigating and seeing what is the real problem, whereas an adult would look at it and would say, well, no, don't be afraid of the snake, it's not going to harm you, right? There's no reason to be afraid of it. But we do this with so many different things. We, you know, take the status of mental illness in the West. And when as soon as we have a problem like depression or anxiety, we're very quick to find a pill that will give us a solution without looking at the cause, without really looking and seeing what's the problem. I think I can't cope, I can't handle. And when in fact the experiences that we have aren't the problem, it's our reactions to them. And a doctor will tell you, of course, that if you want to cure a sickness, you have to find the cause. You have to look at the cause. Well, the same should go with the mind. The same should go with our addictions and our aversions, our mental problems. Because when you look at what's causing you problems, when you examine it, you find that really the answer is not in finding a cure. The cure is not in fixing things. Cure is learning to see things differently, learning to let go and release yourself from the very idea that there's a problem in the first place. And so, I mean, the real thing, the real deal is our the real problem, it's not that we seek for a cure, it's that we don't understand. So we don't understand the problem, and we're inconsistent in our solution. So some of our ideas might be good, some of our ideas might be bad. We're unable to be consistently successful in solving our problems because we don't look closely at the cause. So, I mean, it's just this idea that in Buddhism we do focus much more on the cause. We're not immediately looking to solve our problems, and that's sort of the difference between Samatha meditation and Vipassana meditation. With Samatha meditation, you're looking for a quick fix. Doesn't solve the problem. With Vipassana meditation, you put aside the cure and the fix in terms of being happy and being peaceful, and in fact insight meditation can be quite unpleasant and chaotic, stressful even. Yes, you're putting it aside in favor of looking at the problem. When you have pain, you look at the pain. Well, that's not pleasant. But the focus on the cause instead of the cure means that you're able to solve problems, to come up with solutions that are actually beneficial. You know, I mean, these boys were looking to be happy. The Buddha points this out quite clearly. Attano sukamesa no, they were seeking happiness. That's why they were doing it. They were doing it to bring happiness. They had the right intention. Their minds weren't clear. They hadn't studied the problem and the situation to the extent that they would really understand what the problem was. And the Buddha goes into, you know, the Buddha sees things beyond what most of us can see and says, not only is it going to be a problem for your minds now, when you're reborn, you're going to get beaten by a stick, or you're going to be in trouble, you might go to hell, that kind of thing. Lots of bad things can happen. So, for our meditation practice, we spend our time studying causes. We don't concern ourselves so much with the peace and the happiness. And that's really, really kind of the beauty of the practice. You know, we're not dependent on results. It's much more about the process. And when happiness does come, because it does come from insight, and make no mistake, insight meditation is designed to bring peace, happiness, freedom from suffering. But when it does come, we're not attached to it, we're not dependent on it. We kind of just, you know, chalk it up to good results and keep going back into the bad stuff. You know? It's like when you're cleaning house. When the room's clean, you leave and go find a dirty room. You do that until you're clean. That's how you clean your house. That's how you clean your mind. Don't sit there and marvel at the clean room and forget about all the rest. You know, oh well, at least this room's clean. Maybe I'll just live in this room and not live in the rest of the rooms in my house. So in meditation, we focus on the bad stuff mostly. It's important that we do. I think that's proper to say. Don't focus on the good stuff. Don't worry about it. Focus on the bad stuff, including how we react to good things. You know, it's not all pain and suffering, but there's greed and addiction as well. But on either side, focusing on what's wrong, just like a doctor would, just like someone cleaning house would. A doctor focuses on the sickness, tries to find the cause. They can give you medication to suppress the symptoms and even cure the sickness. You know, like if a person has abused their body, you know, the doctor can fix the symptoms. But if you go back and abuse your body again, you know, what good is it to cure the symptoms? Even if it's a cure, you just do the same thing over again. So much more important is it to find the cause. And you know, they say an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, right? That's an old saying for this reason. So we're not so much concerned with results. This is a problem meditators have. They're worried that their, you know, things, it's, meditation's not comfortable. Is this meditation actually any good? Where you should find results is in the fixing, in the solving. Sorry, not in the fixing and the solving, in the moment of addressing, not the fixing, but the addressing. When you address the experience and purify the moment, where you look at the experience in a new way. When you have pain, you look at it as just pain. When you have thoughts, you look at them as just thoughts. Even your emotions, learning to look at them and see them just as emotions and not reacting to them. So, that's the Dhammapada verses for today. We're now at up to 132. Wishing you all the best. Have a good night. Okay. That's the Dhammapada for tonight. Does anyone have any questions? Does Theravada Buddhism subscribe to determinism? If so, to what degree? There's degrees of determinism now? That's a new one. How could you have degrees of determinism? Maybe you could. I'm not really ridiculing it. Maybe I am, but it sounds kind of funny. I'm surprised, I guess, that there would be degrees of determinism. My take on it is no, Buddhism doesn't subscribe to determinism. Determinism requires a framework of entities. Buddhism doesn't agree to that. Sort of, it considers it to be an abstraction. That the Buddha was a pragmatist, and so you know, very much is out of. Very much is out of control, but there is the moment, and the idea of whether there is free will or determinism, I think, is beyond the pale of what can be experienced, right? Because experience doesn't show you that it's deterministic or that it's that there's free will. There's only experience, and there are experiences that lead to other experiences. As soon as you start thinking about determinism or free will, you enter into abstraction. You're no longer dealing with ultimate reality. Ultimate reality only has moments of experience. So So there are degrees of determinism? That sounds kind of funny to me. I guess I haven't thought about it properly. But that's the thing, it's not something we should think about. You see, the whole debate about free will and determinism is an abstraction. When you start thinking about it, you've stopped looking at what's really happening here and now. And so it doesn't have a place, I think, in Buddhist philosophy. Others might disagree with me. That's my take on it. I think the free will determinism argument is a red herring. It's not nothing to do with reality. It sounds like it's a kind of a cop-out in a way, but I think it's an important cop-out. I don't think you can come to an answer based on ultimate reality. There's a lot that smacks of determinism in terms of not being non-self, right? But the whole idea of non-self is that there are no entities. There are only experiences. That's it. No more questions. Did we miss one? Oh, here's one. Just wondered what your thoughts are on Buddhism and misogyny. There's a misogynist aspect of Buddhism that nobody talks about. Hinduism is patriarchal. There are more rules for nuns than monks. Women have the additional burden of not arousing desires of men. Well, that's not what all the extra rules are for. And in fact, those rules are all just fence posts. Rules are... I'm not going to deny that there's a lot of misogyny in Buddhism. There's no question. But you know, specific points. This one's not a very good one because rules are just... I mean, we've got hundreds of rules beyond these and... but some of them are. I think you could point to a few that are problematic. So, I don't know. It's not perfect. But, you know, rules are not that big of a deal. I think, where does the misogyny... I mean, the female monks are as a whole, considered to be junior male monks. So, as a whole, they have to... consider themselves to be junior, which is certainly not to be kindly looked upon by people who believe in equality. I mean, I get it. It's not ideal, but it's how it evolved. What? What's this one? This is ridiculous. Monks are advised to sleep indoors. Where a woman had sex with a monk. What? Monks who do not wake up, do not yield to temptation, despite being accosted by women for sexual pleasure, are seen as innocent and not... Why is that misogynistic? A woman comes and rapes a monk, and that's considered misogynistic? Oh wait, maybe I have to read on. Okay, it's better for you to put in all the sense here. Okay, what's it getting at? It's really good Buddhism. Wow, I don't get how all those points were considered misogynistic, but I have to read it maybe more carefully. And it wasn't under a tree. This guy left his door open, and these milkmaids came by and saw him. He had an erection, and so they said, "Oh, what a horse of a man!" And they came and they took turns sitting on him. And the Buddha said, "Yeah, you should lock the door when you sleep." But how could that be misogynistic? I don't get it. Maybe it's the portrayal of women as being like that. I don't know. Certainly a fairly far-fetched story, but you know, strange things happen. Well, all the sense that enslave, and this is just a mistranslation. Wow. It is better for you to put your manhood in the mouth of a venomous snake or a pit of burning charcoal than a woman, because he's a Buddhist monk, for crying out loud. It's not because women are bad. And then here, all the sense that can enslave, the Pali is all the sense that can enslave a man. None is more lethal or more, it's not lethal, none is more powerful, I think, than that of a woman. But then it says the same thing of a woman for a man. You know, what enslaves a woman is the scent of a man. It's absurd. Buddhist monks are not allowed to wander naked. And that's not why. It's not because they would fear they would attract women. This is garbage. Monks are advised to walk straight, lest they get enchanted by the glance of a woman. Sure, that's reasonable. Buddhist monks are trying to be celibate. I mean, what are you trying to get at? That monks should be in congress with women and be associated with women and get close to them because that's good for heterosexual men trying to be celibate. I'm not impressed by this article. Bakula says that in 80 years he has not only not had sex, he's not even entertained the thoughts of a woman. Yeah, he's a Buddhist monk. Good one at that. Once a woman laughed and showed her charms, but he remained unmoved. Mahatissa said he saw no woman, only a heap of bones. I don't get it. Maybe I'm just living under a rock and don't see the misogyny here, but I'm not going to read the rest of it because that's pretty pathetic. I'm not going to deny that there's a lot of misogyny. Anyway, this person's probably. Oh no, still here. But that article doesn't show it. The article's pretty pathetic. I don't quite get it. Oh yeah, your profile's got a problem. The underscore is. I have to add the underscore. I'll do that now. Because we had someone was showing us that they could hack it, and so I restricted it to only use alphanumerical characters. Which one do we have to edit is the question. Profile, right? Okay. Try it now. Let's see, Larry E. Yes, now it should work as expected. Okay. Is no entity synonymous with no self? No entity. Yeah. I mean, it's an aspect of non-self. Non-self has to do with yeah, but no self, right? The no self aspect. But non-self is much more about it's a characteristic of things. Things are non-self, they're not self. Things are non-self in the sense of not being entities, they're non-self in the sense of not being controllable, they're non-self in the sense of not being belonging to anyone, that kind of thing. Can the second noble truth be understood as the cause for Panchakhanda? Again, you're using Sanskrit. I'm so disappointed in Sri Lankan Buddhism that they use Sanskrit words. Use the Pali. Panchakhanda. Panchakhanda as dukkha is inherent in all five of them. I don't get it. Be understood as the cause. Panchakhanda. Yes, I mean the second noble truth, desire is the cause for the arising of the khandhas. It arises because of desire. I mean, not always, but that's the ultimate reason, is why we're reborn, right? So the khandhas can arise, they arise based on each other as well. There's functional khandhas, that kind of thing, I think. But without desire, it all breaks down. Like, for example, an arahant gives up desire, has no desire, as the second noble truth has been abandoned, but the khandhas still arise. So it's not the direct cause always, but it's the long-term cause. That's why we're reborn. As well as why we complicate our lives and that kind of thing. Guadalupe says women are the subject of documents as well as men. Don't you love autocorrect? Subject of defilements. Yeah, women are subject, men are subject. I mean, the Buddha was dealing with a difficult situation. I think you can't deny that. Whatever you might say about his choices of making the Vinaya. And so I would say two things relating to men and women. The first is that a lot of it has to do with the rules, and rules are, you know, much less to do with what's right and wrong as they are to do with what creates social harmony. So it's not wrong to use money, and yet monks aren't allowed to use money because it's it in the end has a great potential to disrupt social harmony and the, you know, and the individual. There's nothing wrong with using money. And so, as far as the rules go, I hope that, you know, people can try their best to just see, and to some extent anyway, that the rules are just rules. And the other, aspect, the most glaring misogyny in Buddhism is actually to do with, it is real misogyny. It's cultivating a repulsion, or not a repulsion, but an understanding of the problem specifically that women have. Why? Because that's useful for men trying to be celibate. Maybe, and so I don't quite mean misogyny, but, you know, like, men and women both have problems, but men aren't for the most part attracted to men. So a lot of men will, let's take monks, you know, a monk ordains, but he still thinks about women. He thinks about getting married. He thinks about how nice it might be to have a wife and children, And so the Buddha would talk from time to time about how evil women can be. But what he means is, you know, you desire something that is a cause, potential cause for suffering for you. If it was a homosexual man, he would talk about, most likely about the problems with men. You know, you want to have a husband. So the most glaring misogyny, I don't have really a problem with it personally. Of course, I'm a man, so who am I to speak? But it doesn't seem problematic to me, because obviously it's this. If it was a woman, he'd be saying the same terrible things about men. You want a husband? Are you crazy? Husband will beat you and rape you, and you know, husband will try to control you and manipulate you. Husbands can be terrible. Men can be terrible. But he didn't say that because he was talking to heterosexual men who weren't looking to have a husband. That kind of thing. How can I identify moha within myself? That question means you have moha. You don't identify moha. You dispel it. When you're mindful, there's no moha. So you use mindfulness. It's like when you shine a light in a dark space. Do you have to shine the light to get rid of the darkness? I mean, do you have to use the light? No. As soon as the light is there, the darkness is gone. There's no activity. You just turn on the light. Mindfulness is like that light. So you won't find it when you're mindful. You don't say, okay, I'll be mindful and then I'll see the moha. Moha is delusion, ignorance. Moha probably literally means confusion or relates to confusion. But delusion is just as good. It's a misapprehension of things, misunderstanding of things through ignorance or through wrong view. Wrong belief, that kind of thing. Wrong perception. It's what leads to greed and anger. So we use mindfulness and we dispel the ignorance. We dispel the delusion. And that helps us see the truth about greed and anger. I mean, delusion is the idea that greed and anger are somehow good. And when you don't have that idea, when you study greed and anger, you lose that idea. And as you lose that idea, you give up greed and anger. Moha is darkness. Moha is confusion and ignorance and that kind of thing. Worry is a kind of delusion. Anxiety. Doubt is a kind of a delusion. Confusion, that kind of thing. Arrogance and conceit, those are kinds of delusion. Anyway, let's call it a night for tonight, and I'll see you all tomorrow. You see, the Dhammapada should be up soon, or maybe tonight, maybe tomorrow. It's transcoding right now. Yeah, I thought degrees of determinism would be a bit of not an oxymoron, but it's like, you know how they say, that's a really perfect, there are certain adjectives that you can't use as, you can't qualify with adverbs, like really perfect or really unique, you know? Something's either unique or it's not. I mean, that's what it reminds me of. There are certain words that don't have degrees to them, so I thought determinism was one. I think maybe I get what you're talking about, like the bidet experiments, the raising the hand experiments, and the idea that there still might be a potential for the mind to choose to act or not. which is probably close to, if you look at Locke, John Locke had some interesting things to say about that sort of thing. I really think Locke could be interpreted as in a way similar to Buddhism. I mean, at least they were thinking about these things. Anyway, have a good night, everyone.